Kunja, Krishna Prasaya Bhutalesi, Mate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Namine, Namaste Sarasvati Deve, Gauravani Patani, Nuse Sasinivani Paskatya De Satani, Mandeham Sri Guru Sri Yuta Padakamalam Sri Gurun Vaishnavam Stra, Sri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunatam Vitam Sam Sajivam, Sadvaitam Sadvadutam Parijana Sahita Krishna Chaitanya Deva, Sri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Sri Vishakam Vitamscha. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. September 24th, 2013, in Hilo, Hawaii, class over Skype, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 8, Prayers by Queen Kunti and Parikit Saved, Text 32. Kechid Ahura Jam Jatam. Punyaslokasya kirtaye yado priyasya nyavaya malayasyeva chandanam. Kechit, someone, ahu, says, Ajam, the unborn, Jatam, being born, Punyaslokasya, of the great pious king, Kirtaye, for glorifying, Yadaho, of King Yadu, Priyasya, of the deer, that's D-E-A-R, not D-E-E-R, Antavaye, in the family of, Malayasya, Malaya Hills, Eva, as Chandanam, Sandalwood. Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. Some say that the unborn is born for the glorification of pious kings, and others say that he is born to please King Yadu, one of your dearest devotees. You appear in his family as sandalwood appears in the Malaya Hills. Purport. Because the Lord's appearance in this material world is bewildering, there are different opinions about the birth of the unborn. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says that he takes his birth in the material world, although he is the Lord of all creations and he is unborn. So there cannot be any denial of the birth of the unborn, because he himself establishes the truth. But still, there are different opinions as to why he takes his birth. That is also declared in the Bhagavad Gita. He appears by his own internal potency to reestablish the principles of religion and to protect the pious and to annihilate the impious. That is the mission of the appearance of the unborn. Still, it is said that the Lord is there to glorify the pious King Yudhisthira. Lord Sri Krishna certainly wanted to establish the kingdom of the Pandavas for the good of all in the world. When there is a pious king ruling over the world, the people are happy. When the ruler is impious, the people are unhappy. In the age of Kali, in most cases, the rulers are impious, and therefore the citizens are also continuously unhappy. But in the case of democracy, the impious citizens themselves elect their representative to rule over them, and therefore they cannot blame anyone for their unhappiness. Maharaj Nala was also celebrated as a great pious king, but he had no connection with Lord Krishna. Therefore, Maharaj Yudhisthira is meant here to be glorified by Lord Krishna. He had also glorified King Yadu, having taken his birth in the family. He is known as Yadava, Yaduvira, Yadunandana, etc., although the Lord is always independent of such obligation. He is just like the sandalwood that grows in the Malaya Hills. Trees can go anywhere and everywhere. Yet because the sandalwood trees go mostly in the area of the Malaya Hills, the name sandalwood and the Malaya Hills are interrelated. Therefore, the conclusion is that the Lord is ever unborn like the sun, and yet he appears as the sun rises on the eastern horizon. As the sun is never the sun, S-O-N, of the eastern horizon, so the Lord is no one's son, but he is the father of everything that be. Kate Shirahur Ajam Jatam Punya Slokas Yakirtaye Yado Priyas Yanvavaya Aye Malayas Yevai Malayas Yevachandanam. Some say that the unborn is born for the glorification of pious kings, and others say that he is born to please King Yadu, one of your dearest devotees. You appear in his family as sandalwood appears in the Malaya Hills. So here, Queen Kunti, Kate Chit Ahu, is saying, some people say this, some people say this, some people say that. But what are the reasons for the birth of the Lord? So Prabhupada says the fact of the Lord being born cannot be contested. Some people might say, well, God never comes here. God can't be born here. But Krishna says, janma karma chame divyam. So Krishna's using the word janma, and we have, of course, our festival, Janmastami, that Krishna is taking birth. So Krishna certainly is born, although he's not exactly born like an ordinary child. Prabhupada says that Krishna did not come out of Devaki's womb, but rather he just appeared. You know, he was in her womb, and then, woof, there he was in the room. And there he was in the room with four hands and a helmet and clothing and jewels. So I've been to many births, and I've never seen that. I've never seen a child just appear, and I've never seen a child even come out of the womb with jewels and helmet. Of course, Karna did, though Karna was a jiva, Karna did appear with helmet and armor. But anyway, we have not seen and earrings, not helmet, earrings and armor. So we've not seen such a baby. But Krishna came out, didn't come out, he just appeared. There he was, with four hands, and then he turned himself into an ordinary baby at the request of his parents. So that's not really a birth. Although Krishna says, janma, Krishna says he had a birth. So superficially, one could say that he was born. In other incarnations, Krishna may have been born. For example, it's with Lord Kapila Dev, it said that the Lord entered into the semen of the father, Kardama Muni. So there may be some instance in which the Lord is factually born in the way that most children are born. But even when the Lord is apparently born, even when the Lord apparently comes out of a womb, like a child comes out of a womb, we don't hear about Lord Chaitanya just appearing in the room like Krishna did. But even then, he's still the unborn. He's still never born. In fact, not only is Krishna never born, but none of us are ever born either. Ajo, nityashasvato yam prano nahanyate hanyamane shriye. Ajo, we are also unborn. So Krishna is called unborn, and it's interesting in this purport that the BBT editors in two places capitalize unborn, the birth of the unborn. After the word the, they've capitalized the unborn as a name of Krishna. In Prabhupada's early Bhagavatam that he did in India, he capitalized lots and lots of nouns, which is in keeping with German grammar. In German grammar, all nouns, not only proper nouns, are capitalized. In English, we only capitalize proper nouns. But here, the editors decided that the word unborn, at least in two cases, was a proper noun when it came after the word the, whereas other cases in this purport, when the word unborn is used, it's not capitalized. So Krishna can be called the unborn as one of his names. Of course, Lord Brahma is also called unborn, because he manifests on a lotus flower. He doesn't even manifest through Lakshmiji. He has no mother. He only has a father. And he has no birth in any kind of a sense. In fact, even Brahma's sons aren't born. They're manifested from his mind or from his thumb or from his shadow. He doesn't go through some process where he unites with Sarasvati and she gives birth to them. In fact, it's described with Daksha, when Daksha offended Lord Shiva, that one of his punishments was that in his next life he had to actually be born. He had to enter into the womb of Marisha and be born. And in that life he was born as a Kshatriya, whereas in his life as a son of Lord Brahma, he's a Brahmana, and he didn't have to go through the process of birth. So birth is one of the four miseries of the world, that all of a sudden you're thrust into a situation that you don't understand, you don't know where you are. This birth and death, as Krishna says, for one who has died, birth is certain. For one who has been born, death is certain. This relinquishing and accepting of an identity. I mean, why is it so awful? Why is it that Krishna is here called the unborn, to be distinguished from the living entities? So this birth and death are awful because they're the relinquishing of something we've invested in. Just like when there's some natural catastrophe and a person's house gets flooded, or there were recently some floods in Colorado, and a friend of mine had the house she was staying in completely ruined by the floods. So, you know, if you look around where you're sitting, if you're sitting in your own room or your own house, and you can think of what you've invested in that place. So you've invested something to plan out how you want it to be, to buy whatever is in the room, to organize things. You've spent a lot of time and energy and care and thought. And maybe you've spent money, which is the result of indirectly time and energy and care and thought. So one earns money by time and energy. So either time and energy directly or time and energy indirectly through money. And then if that all gets ruined, then you think, oh, I've invested everything for nothing. I've invested everything for nothing. When I was growing up, I had a good friend whose parents lived in rented houses, always lived in rented houses, one rented house after another. And my friend's mother had this dream that I'm going to own my own house. And she was an artist, and her dream was, I'm going to own my own house, and I'm going to decorate it the way I like. So finally, they bought a house, and they got to decorate it exactly the way that they wanted. And all throughout the house, the walls were all painted with various designs. All around the windows, there were flowers and leaves. And the house was like a painting. It was like a work of art. And I think it was 2 weeks. It was either 1 or 2 weeks after they moved into the house. Her husband had a heart attack. He couldn't work anymore. They couldn't afford the mortgage. And they had to give up their house. So it was so devastating because she'd been working for this and dreaming of it her whole life. And they invested so much care into it. And then it was gone. So birth and death is like that. We're investing a lot into our identity. You know, I am so-and-so. I am Sue Smith. You know, I am Komal Patel. This is who I am. And this is my family. We invest so much into our family relationships. We put so much time and energy and care into getting along with our family members and pleasing them and doing what they like. And we put so much care into our education and our talents and what we're specialized in, all of our relationships outside the family. I mean, so much energy into this, and then at death it's all swept away, and then again at birth we have to start over again. Of course, we're not starting totally over again, because a lot of our relationships carry over from one life to the next, but they're in a different context. You know, someone who was your enemy in your last life may be your family member in this life, and you have to rebuild your relationship in another context. So this is very painful for the living entity. We are meant to have an eternal relationship and an eternal identity with Krishna, where there's no loss, where everything that we're investing in Krishna and everything that we're investing in ourselves is real and permanent. You know, it's who we really are. We have in the spiritual world, we have our eternal family members. You know, Krishna has his mother and father and his brother and Vrindavan, and then in Dwarka and Mathura, he has also mother and father. And there in Dwarka, he has 100 brothers and sisters and so many family members. And that's all eternal. You know, Srimati Radharani, she has her mother and father and her brother and her sister and her cousins. And Rupa Goswami has this book, Radhakrishna Guru Ganadesh Dipika, where he details a lot of the intimate family members of Radha and Krishna. And everyone in the spiritual world has their eternal family and their eternal identity and their likes and dislikes, and they have their clothes and they have their furniture. Yad bhava bhavita diyo manujasta daiva samprapya rupa mahima samyana bhusha suktaya meva nigama pratitayastu bhanti. We have our furniture. It says asana. We even have our chairs. There are eternal chairs. You know. So right now in this room I have a rocking chair that I got at a office store where they were selling their old furniture. But this is not my eternal rocking chair. I've had other chairs. This one will be finished at some point. But we have in the spiritual world our eternal chairs, our eternal home. And it's all Chintamani Prakrasadmashu. Everything is conscious. Everything that's eternal, it's also conscious. It's alive. There's no matter. And all the relationships are in harmony. It's not that you invest everything in relationships and then still they don't work out, or you invest everything in your house and still it's being eaten by termites. You know, your investments are in something that's solid and conscious and beautiful, and where you have real relationships with your chairs and real relationships with your walls and relationships with your floors, and because they're all conscious beings. So that's our actual position. So with that position, why would anybody want to take birth? Why would anybody want to go into a material body full of mucus, bile, and air, and pus, and blood, and bones, and assume some temporary identity into which one pours the energy that one, by constitution, should be pouring into one's eternal identity, just to have it smashed? And, of course, in a sane society, it's smashed pretty much only at death. In our modern society, everything is smashed over and over again, even in this life. Like Prabhupada says in this purport, when there's a pious king, the people are happy, and when the ruler is impious, the people are unhappy. So in our present impious age, people are so unhappy that people are practically dying over and over and over again in the course of their life. So many natural disturbances, so much crime, so much divorce, and all these things are like little deaths. You know, half the families are breaking up, and basically it's like the death of your investment. It's such a painful, painful, painful situation for everyone involved. And what to speak of for the children, who are kind of like innocent bystanders in the carnage. And natural disasters, which are the result of living impiously. And then, you know, crime. You just go shopping. You're just going out to buy, you know, some milk. And then you get shot in the head by some madman at the mall or the grocery store. And the government can't do anything about it. You know, the heads of state just get on television and say, "We're so sorry for this crisis. You know, we mourn this crisis. Our heart goes out to all the victims of the shooting," you know. But they can't do anything about it. And this is going on increasingly all over the world. So people have, you know, they have to start all over again and start all over again and start all over again, even in this life. So who would ever do that? So we, the living entity, although we're unborn, ajo, nicha, shasvato, yam, purano, although we're unborn and we don't die, we're doing this out of, we have to say, idiocy, foolishness, rebellion, envy. Like a child who gets angry at their parents, and in their anger at their parents, they break their own toys. We're exactly like that. Out of envy for Krishna, we destroyed our own situation. And we're so stubbornly hanging on to this, that although Krishna is begging us, please come back to your eternal position, we refuse. We refuse. And we're being forced to take body after another due to our envy. Daivanetrena. So we're under the divine vision. Supervision. We have this English word, supervision. And in Sanskrit, daivanetrena. Divine vision. We're being forced to take birth over and over again. Of course, we're not exactly being forced. We're being forced because we want it. You know, and Krishna is a desire-fulfilling tree. Krishna's love for the living entities is such that he wants to fulfill all their desires, and if they desire something foolish, he'll tell them it's foolish, but he will fulfill their desires. Krishna never withholds from the living entity what they desire. So you could say that we're forced to get what we want. You know, when we say one's forced to get a body and one's forced to experience certain things, it's because we want those things. So Krishna's saying, okay, you want them, here they are. Here they are. So that's, we're forced, but we're forced to experience our own choices. As soon as we choose Krishna, then we're no longer forced. So how is it really, in the ultimate issue, how is it, it's forced? It's not forced against our will. And not like that. That was Arjuna's question. He says, it seems. He says, it seems that I'm acting sinfully against my will. It seems I'm being forced to do sinful things. And I think most of us conditioned souls feel that way. We feel, you know, I wake up in the morning with a resolution. Today I'm not going to yell at my children. And then an hour later or a minute later, there we are yelling at our children. Or, you know, I make some resolution. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. You know, I'm not going to eat too much. And then there's a cake in front of us and we eat it. And it seems to us that, wait a minute, that I'm being forced against my will. And it's interesting that when you point out to people that they're doing something wrong, they'll usually try to excuse themselves by describing the circumstances surrounding the situation. And I'm just a victim of the circumstances. Well, you don't understand what was going on, and it was like this and like this, and this person said that, and this person did this, and this, so I had to do it. So we feel like that. That's our, you know, we feel like Maya is being imposed on me against my will, that if it was my choice, that I would choose eternal happiness and I would choose unlimited knowledge, practically unlimited knowledge. Not like God, but. And I would choose full power and full youthfulness. Of course I would choose those things. All these things are being forced on me. Birth, death, old age, and disease are being forced on me. And when Arjuna said this to Krishna, did Krishna say, yes, these are all being forced on you? He said, no, it's your own lust. It's your own lust. So one can say, like Prabhupada will sometimes say, we are being forced to take birth. But this force is due to our own lust. It's something like if the criminal says, I'm being forced to go to jail. But nobody forced you to commit the crime, sir. You know, so what is this force? This force is a direct response to one's own desires. It's the natural response to one's own desires. You know, the drug addict can say, I'm forced to lie in the gutter in my vomit. No, sir, you're the one who took the drug. And therefore, this so-called force is a matter of your own lust. And then when we're in this world with birth, death, old age, and disease, then we're lamenting and lamenting. Oh, why am I here? Why am I suffering? Why doesn't God do something about it? Why doesn't God save me from my suffering? If God really loved me, he would make everything nice for me. Not realizing that we're the architects of our own fortune and that God is more than willing. He's intensely eager to give us a situation not only of spiritual prosperity, but even of material prosperity. Krishna's desire is that we act in such a way that we would be happy and prosperous in all respects. A Vedic society is a society, just like when Lord Ramachandra ruled the world. And here we're talking about pious kings. When Lord Ramachandra ruled the world, there was no anxiety and there was no disease, and people only died if they wanted to. So that's the kind of society that Krishna wants to have, even in the material world. And we are the ones who do the opposite. Like Prabhupada says here, it's so funny. He says that in democracy, the impious citizens elect their representative, and therefore they cannot blame anyone for their unhappiness. But of course they do. So the citizens, after electing their representative, then they turn around and blame him and say, oh, it's all the representative's fault. But they're the one who said, please be our leader. Please be our leader. And then instead of seeing their own responsibility, they blame the leader. So Krishna doesn't take birth like that. Although Krishna is born, janma, Krishna is not taking birth because to enjoy the material energy at the force of material energy. If that were so, then Krishna would be an ordinary person like us. Of course, many people think that Krishna is an ordinary person like us, many scholars and historians and even so-called followers of the Vedas, Maya Paritya Jnana. They simply think like that. Namam duskritino mudha. Duskritam prapadyante niradam Maya Paritya Jnana asuram bhavam asmitam. The demons, the foolish people, they don't understand that Krishna is not an ordinary person. So Krishna's birth is out of his own freedom. He's coming here because he wants to. Then you might say, well, that doesn't make sense. Why would God want to come here? I mean, we want to come here because we're fools. And then we kind of get stuck. But God's not a fool, so why would he want to come here? So some of the reasons are given here, that he's come to please King Yadu. And Prabhupada has quite an explanation here in the purport, because here it says, Punya Slokasya Kirtaya Yadu. So he comes for the glorification of pious kings and born to please King Yadu. So maybe it was King Yadu, who of course lived a long time before Krishna's appearance, that, oh, the Lord will be born later on in my dynasty. In fact, that's one of the reasons why Yadu refused to accept the old age of his father, that he wanted to produce children because he knew that Krishna would take birth in his dynasty. And here this Punya Slokasya Kirtaye, to glorify, to give fame to the Punya Slokasya, to the person who has, sloka is verses, punya is pious, for the person of whom there are pious slokas. So who is that exactly? It's really unclear. But Prabhupada says in the purport that this means the pious kings, and it must refer to Yudhisthira rather than another pious king such as Nala, who's in the Mahabharata, because Nala is not directly related with Lord Krishna, whereas Maharaj Yudhisthira is. So maybe Krishna takes birth to glorify his devotees like Yadu, who wants him. Maybe he takes birth to glorify devotees like Maharaj Yudhisthira by appearing in his dynasty. And of course, there's many other reasons why Krishna takes birth. As he says himself, yada yada hi dharmasya glanur bhavati bhavatai bhutyanam dharmasya tadatmanam srutamyaham paritranaya sadunam vinashaya tadushkritam dharmastam stapanartaya sambhavami yuge yuge. He takes birth, or he sends his representatives. Krishna's representatives also are not born like an ordinary conditioned soul, in order to uplift the world. And it has to be done over and over and over and over and over. Just like you have to clean your house over and over. You can't clean it once and then it stays clean. Or you have to bathe over and over. You have to brush your teeth over and over. So Dharma has to be reestablished over and over. And of course, ultimately, Krishna appears for sweet reciprocations with his devotees and to entice the conditioned souls, to show them, this is what spiritual relationships are like. This is what the spiritual world is like. Please come home, please come home, please come home. So ultimately Krishna takes birth for those reasons. And I was just reading, I think it was in the third canto, where Prabhupada was saying there's no necessity for creation of the material world, even for Krishna's pastimes. So whatever Krishna wants to enjoy, he doesn't need the material world to enjoy it, but he comes here out of mercy and out of freedom, as the great devotees do. That's described nicely in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita, how Gopakumar sees the Vishnu Dutas, and how the Vishnu Dutas are going from Vaikuntha to the various material universes. And they're doing that simply to help anybody who at the time of death is hearing or chanting even the shadow of the holy name of the Lord, to rescue them and to help them so they may come into the world like happened with Ajamil, that there it is at the time of death, that the Vishnu Dutas were there as Vishnu Dutas. And it may be that they come into the world and apparently take birth, just like it is said that the associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are Nitya Siddhas. There's one letter where Prabhupada says that particularly Rupa Goswami and Raghunath Das Goswami are Nitya Siddha devotees. He said the other six Goswami, the other four Goswamis are Sadhana Siddha devotees. So, but some devotees, they are eternally perfect and simply to assist Krishna in his mission. They come to entice us. And Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, if we understand this, janma karma cha medyam evam yo veti tatva deham punar janma naiti mam eti sorjana, that if we understand this truth about Krishna, then we ourselves no longer are forced to take birth. Then we ourselves get our original inheritance of being unborn entities, where we don't have to do this over and over again, sandcastle building. You know, you see some people make these beautiful sand sculptures and then the waves just come and wash them away. So instead of building these sandcastles, we can build our eternal home. So for this reason, among others, we hear about Krishna and we can meditate on his qualities and how he's unborn, and we can meditate on who we really are. And then we can invest in that. Of course, we should take care of our home and our furniture, and we should take care of our human relations as a service. But not that we're investing our happiness in them. Not that we think my happiness is dependent on my home and my room. My happiness is dependent on how my family members treat me. And then we're investing ourselves in these things which are all going to die. They're all going to crumble. They're all going to disappoint us. And then again birth, and then again death, and then again birth. Little births and deaths, big births and deaths. So I had a really nice example of this principle of working to please Krishna. I was gone to another island here in Hawaii for 2 weeks. I just came back last night, and when I came back, my 8-year-old granddaughter said, "Grandma, Grandma, I have a surprise for you. I have a surprise for you." And I was thinking, what kind of surprise does she have? Some kind of special food? Some present that I was thinking like that. I was thinking that it was some sort of present for me. And I was thinking, I wonder what kind of surprise I have. I was very intrigued. And then I came in the house. She said, "Not yet, Grandma, not yet. Just wait, just wait." You know, what is she talking about? And then she says, "Okay, come into my room." So I went into her room. And I said, "Everything's clean." Because when I first came here, her room was a mess. There was like 6 inches worth of clothes all over the floor. And I had her and her sisters clean up the room. And then after that, I would go in every single day. And I'd say, "Okay, is the room cleaned up? Is there anything on the floor? Okay, let's come clean it up. Whose is this? And every single day, without fail, every day, I went in the room and made sure that the three girls cleaned up their room. So it was really interesting that my granddaughter wanted to clean her room not for her own personal enjoyment, but to please me. So that's how we should do everything in this world. Not for our personal enjoyment, but to please Krishna. Not let me clean my house so I'll enjoy a clean house, but let me clean my house as a gift to Krishna. Not let me treat my husband, my wife, my children, my parents nicely so that they'll be nice to me and they'll have a sweet relationship with me and I'll enjoy that relationship, but so Krishna will be pleased. So Krishna will look and say, "Oh Krishna, here's my gift to you." Then we are working and living on the platform of the unborn. Then there's no death for us. Death of what? We have no investments. Death is miserable only for one who's invested in this world. If I've cleaned my room for Krishna and I've treated my wife nicely for Krishna, then if I lose my room at Krishna's pleasure, or my wife is nasty to me, or my wife leaves me, or she dies, as Krishna's desire. Then with no investment, there's no pain of death. That is actual sannyas. Actual sannyas is not just that you wear fire-colored clothes, and you give up sex and money, and you give up control, and you just depend on the mercy of the Lord externally. But real sannyas is everything is dedicated to Krishna, and your happiness is in Krishna. My granddaughter's happiness was in my happiness. She was not directly trying to enjoy the clean room. In fact, I don't think she cares personally if the room is clean or not. I don't think it makes the slightest bit of difference to her. Her happiness was that I was pleased. So she knew, Grandma wants me to clean my room. She knew because I told her, and she knew because I demonstrated it over and over again by my actions. So I didn't ask her, I didn't say, would you please clean your, have your room clean when I come back? It's funny, I was thinking, oh my God, I'm going to come back, there's going to be clothes all over the floor again, I'm going to have to retrain them all over again. But without my saying that, she knew what would please me. And her happiness was my happiness. And she was very happy. But she was happy in my happiness. She wasn't happy in the room itself, which she didn't care about at all. See, we think, if I don't care about the things in this world, I won't do them anymore. We think, well, if I don't care about pleasing my husband, then I won't try to please my husband. Then I'll just be mean to him, or I'll just be neglectful of him. But it's not like that. It wasn't that she trashed her room because she didn't care about it. Her not caring about it for herself meant that she took better care of it when she wanted to please me. She took better care of her room than if she would have done it for herself. So then we become unborn. Our investments are in Krishna and Krishna's pleasure. We may appear to be an ordinary person of the world. Maharaj Yudhisthira may have appeared to be an ordinary king of the world, a good, pious king who took care of the citizens. He appeared to care very much. After the Battle of Kurukshetra, he was devastated. Oh, so many people have been harmed. So we may appear to care very much. We may appear to care more than an ordinary person. Because when you're doing it for Krishna, then your determination is unbreakable. When you're doing it for yourself, then if you don't get what you want, you lose your determination. Oh, why should I do this anymore? So when we're working for Krishna, our determination is unbreakable, our happiness is on the eternal platform, and even in this world, we're no longer really being born and dying at all. Apparently, for the liberated soul, the body's born and dying, but really it's not. The liberated soul is not experiencing like that because their investment is in the eternal. So therefore, Krishna says, when we understand that he is unborn, when we understand that he's coming here just out of freedom, then we regain our birthright, so to speak, dayabak, our inheritance, of also being unborn. And then we're in the world untouched by the world. We're working hard in the world. We appear to be working like an ordinary person to please others and make things nice and all this sort of stuff and be moral and ethical. But then we're so far above morals and ethics. We're so far above being a good person. All right, we're functioning in a different sphere of complete freedom. That we're acting in the world not to get something or because we're supposed to, but we're acting in the world just to see Krishna smile. And we know it will make Krishna smile, just like my granddaughter knew it would make me happy. I'm not going to hide from my grandchildren what will make me happy. It's not that they have to just guess, well, what's going to make Grandma happy? So Krishna doesn't hide from us what makes him happy. He makes it very obvious what makes him happy. One who is not envious, but is a kind friend to all living entities, who does not think himself a proprietor, who's free from false ego, who's equal in happiness and distress, fame and infamy, heat and cold, honor and dishonor, who's not attached to any residence, who treats alike friends and enemies. That's what makes Krishna happy. He says, this is what makes me happy. Who sticks to the path of devotional service in inauspicious circumstances, whatever happens, whose mind and intelligence is fixed on him. That's what makes Krishna happy. So that's not a difficult thing to do, really. It's our actual nature to do it. Then we no longer feel forced by the material energy. So questions, comments, additions, subtractions?
Question here. Now you say that everything that we do, by the way, thank you for your class. That was very wonderful. Very, very good truth that you have spoken. But I have a question. Now, you're saying that everything we do should be for the pleasure of Krishna. So the question would be, what is that pleases the Krishna the most?
All right, well, Krishna himself says what pleases him the most. He doesn't make it a secret. Right? Krishna says, exactly, this is what pleases me the most. He says, those who follow this imperishable path of devotional service and who completely engage themselves with faith, making me the supreme goal, are very, very dear to me. For one who explains the supreme secret to the devotees, pure devotional service is guaranteed, and at the end he will come back to me. There is no servant in the world more dear to me than he, nor will there ever be one more dear. So those are the two things that please Krishna the most. To follow this imperishable path of devotional service. It cannot perish. It cannot die. There's no circumstance in which it cannot exist. And completely engage themselves with faith that, yes, if I just please Krishna, I will have everything. Making me the supreme goal. You know, I might have a goal that I've got to, you know, buy a gallon of milk today, and I may have a goal that I got to teach my kid, you know, the letter P or something. But Krishna is the supreme goal. Follow the imperishable path of devotional service, completely engage themselves with faith, making Krishna the supreme goal. So that Krishna says is the most dear, and then he says, for one who explains this secret to the devotees, there is no servant in the world more dear to me than he. And the other things Krishna says are dear, as we've already said, one who's not envious, kind friend to all living entities, equal in happiness, distress, tolerant, satisfied, self-controlled, engage in devotional service with determination, he for whom no one is put into difficulty and who is not disturbed by anyone, equal poise in happiness and distress, fear and anxiety, not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, pure, expert, without cares, free from all pains, not striving for some result, neither rejoices nor grieves, neither laments nor desires, renounces both auspicious and inauspicious, equal to friends and enemies, equal poise in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, flame and infamy, free from contaminating association, always silent and satisfied with anything, doesn't care for any residence, fixed in knowledge, engaged in devotional service. So those are the things that please Krishna. He's very clear. You don't have to guess. You have to say, I wonder what pleases him. What could I do that would please him? And he says, Patram pushpam palam toyam yom me bhaktir prayachati. Just give me a little water, little flower, little leaf. It's like five baseline, minimum things we have to offer in deity worship every day. Flower, incense, scent, food. That was the last one.
Water.
I said water? Food, water. Okay, food. Food, water, incense, lamp. Food, water, incense, lamp, and scent. So those five things, a minimum every day. So Krishna says, this is what pleases me. We don't have to guess. We don't have to think, you know, was it this, was it this, was it this. And then we have Guru. We have Srila Prabhupada. And they're going to tell us, okay, right now, in 2013... on the earth planet, this is what's going to please Krishna. So it says in the Bhagavatam, brahmacharis wear matted hair, but that's not a good idea right now. Lord Chaitanya didn't like devotees having matted hair and deer skin, so that's not going to please Krishna right now. So what will be, you know, some of the details, because that's going to change, Deshkalapatra, what's going to be pleasing to Krishna in different circumstances. But the basic stuff, that's... Krishna's very upfront about it. He doesn't make you guess. He's not playing some sort of a game, you know. Well, I'm not going to tell you what's going to please me. You know, you just have to figure it out by trial and error. No, it's not like that.
Mataji, I have a question.
Go ahead.
As far in this section of the prayers of Queen Kunti, she's really concentrating on the reason why Krishna takes his birth, although he is unborn. And we learn from the Bhagavad Gita, Janma Karma Chamedhyam. So, just by reading these verses, hearing the classes, we certainly understand Krishna's birth and activities, you know, if we pay attention. By that verse of Bhagavad Gita, we should be liberated. However, we certainly don't feel liberated at this stage. So can you qualify what he means by Chaktva Dehan Punarjanma, Naiti Mami Disorjana?
Well, different commentators say different things on that verse, and I can't find it fast enough, but there's two commentators who say that even a slight understanding of Krishna's birth and activities will liberate you, and others say that one has to have a deep realization. But I would say our understanding, whether or not we understand Krishna's nature, is demonstrated by our own behavior. So if we really understand that Krishna is unborn, he is here out of freedom, he's here out of love, then we also will see, oh, I'm part of Krishna. I am also unborn. And we start to act on the platform of love instead of lust. We will experience liberation. We'll experience a sense of freedom. We'll experience a sense of joy. In fact, if we don't experience those things, we're doing something wrong. Prabhupada says that if you're eating, you should feel nourished. He says, if you're eating, but you say, I'm not nourished, then he said, either you're not really eating or there's parasites in your stomach. So he says, if you say, I'm in Krishna consciousness, but I'm not feeling satisfied, I'm not feeling joyful, then either you're not really doing Krishna consciousness or you're committing some serious sort of offense. So I see that those two things are very common. Not really being in the process of bhakti, but thinking one is. Doing something else that's mixed bhakti and calling it bhakti. I see that all the time. And the other is being offensive. And I see that all the time too. You know, or it's okay, I got an email today. Isn't it okay to offend the offenders? You know, I had said to somebody, don't fault find the fault finders. And then I get this email. But it's good to fault find the fault finders. You have to fault find the fault finders. So, you know, we're... So their fault finding is bad, but my fault finding is okay. You know, so we commit offenses. We commit offenses. What to say? Or we're not following the process of bhakti. We're calling something bhakti that's not bhakti. We're doing karma mijra bhakti or gyan mijra bhakti or something like that. We're engaging in bhakti as if it's some sort of a ritual. But as soon as we engage in bhakti proper, even for a moment, then in that moment, we're going to feel joy and freedom. And I think we've all experienced this. It's not, you know, this is not fruit of work. It's not like I'm going to work, and then I'm going to feel joy and freedom at the end. Like, you know, so many religionists say, work and sacrifice, and then you'll go to heaven and you'll enjoy. The moment we're engaged in pure bhakti, without offense, in that moment, we'll feel joy and freedom and peace. Immediately. We've all had this experience. I'm sure we've all had this experience. That we have these moments of incredible, genuine joy and freedom and peace that's not material. And we just go, wow, what was that? So that means that in that moment, we're actually in bhakti. We're performing pure bhakti without offense, at least in a basa. At least, even a shadow of bhakti is very, very powerful and overwhelming. So that's our evidence procedure. You know, our evidence procedure. I say this all the time. It's directly experienced. And if we're not directly experiencing it, the responsibility is 100% on us. Krishna's in every atom. Krishna's in our heart. Krishna's everywhere. Pure bhakti is available to us in the very air we breathe. Pure bhakti is available to us in the sun that's shining in our head. In the digestion of our foodstuff, in our ability, which is all Krishna. So, you know, take those moments and expand them. And I mean, I'm talking to myself too. And stop making excuses for all of our, you know, all of our offenses. Well, it's okay that I'm committing offenses because I have this reason and that reason and the other reason, and going around in this society of devotees just attacking the other devotees and defending ourselves. And I just got another email like that today, unbelievable, of somebody just defending themselves. And, you know, when they were obviously should have just said, it was a conflict between two devotees, and one of them was obviously on the right, and the other one should have just said, I'm really sorry, let me fix this. And instead, he's just attacking the other and criticizing the other and defending himself. And then we say, oh, the reason I'm not experiencing liberation, the reason I don't feel liberated, is because it's Krishna's fault, or the process is so hard, or the process is so slow, or the GBC didn't pass the right resolution, or something, you know, or my wife is bad. That's why I'm not feeling bliss, because I have a bad wife. You know, I get emails like that too. It's all my wife's fault that I'm not a devotee. It's all my mother's fault. It's all somebody's fault. It's all President Obama's fault. You know, it's the radiation in the water or something. Hare Krishna, you know. So.
You know, we have a whole lineup of three other questions, if you can take them. Actually, Vidagya Prabhu, Harsh Prabhu was in front of you, if you don't mind. He could ask a problem. Harsh Prabhu, you are, all you have to do is unmute yourself and we'll be able to hear you. Oh, Harsh is here. Maybe he doesn't have a microphone.
Can you hear me, Prabhu? Do you know?
Yes, now we can hear you.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you very much for nice words, Mother. This is the first question which you actually talked about. There were two things. One was the specific things, like you said, 2013 and the matted hair thing. And there were the general things which you read from the 12 chapter themes. So as I understand, we cannot understand the specifics until unless we are trying to follow the general to a very great degree. Is that correct?
Generally, we have to remember Krishna's in our heart. He's Chaita Guru. And Prabhupada would often say that Krishna consciousness can be achieved in a moment. It's not that first you have to become pious and then you can engage in bhakti. The hunter Magrari did not go from impiety to piety to bhakti. He went from impiety to bhakti immediately. Valmiki went directly from impiety to bhakti. The prostitute who tried to disturb Haridas Thakur went immediately from impiety and blasphemy, in fact. Blasphemy, she was trying to destroy Haridas Thakur. She went directly from there to bhakti. She didn't first become a pious person. It wasn't that, you know, first she was practicing the process for a long time and then she... No. Immediate. So one can take to bhakti directly and in one moment achieve bhakti if we want. Most of us don't have that amount of faith, therefore we take some time. Bahunam janmanam mante gyanamamam papadite vasudevam sarvamiti samahatmasadvarlabaha. So generally we take a lot of lifetimes. But we don't have to. That's frankly, it's our choice. So one can understand Krishna immediately, in a moment. But generally it doesn't work like that. Generally, first we're following the process and we read about Krishna in a general way and we read and gradually increase our faith. Really what we're doing in the gradual process is we're gradually increasing our faith and our desire. But if one chooses to have full faith and full desire immediately, it's available immediately. It's not that Krishna's demanding the gradual process. This is our natural state. So how gradual it is our choice. If we're not comfortable with immediate surrender, then we're welcome to take things gradually. We don't have a philosophy that you have to surrender right now or you go to hell eternally. Krishna says if you don't become perfect in this life, you can have a good birth next life and you'll keep going up. And Krishna's patient. You know, he told Gopakumar he was dancing like a fool waiting for him to surrender. But at the same time, Krishna's patient. And if we want to take a few thousand lifetimes to surrender, you know, he'll wait. and he'll help us as fast as we're willing to go. But to say, well, I can't possibly understand Krishna right now, this minute, because I have to do all sorts of preliminary things, that's the yoga ladder, but that's not bhakti. Bhakti doesn't require any preliminaries. Bhakti doesn't require any qualifications. The only qualification for bhakti is a desire. So generally, that desire will awaken gradually. But it doesn't have to awaken gradually. And there's so many instances of persons for whom it awakened immediately.
I was asking not about bhakti or impiety, piety. What is I asking? To please Krishna, that's like how to know what pleases him. So there are general things like the chapter 12 thing, and there are specific, like in the chapter 7 we had, Arjuna had to decide how to deal with Ashwatthama. So what I was understanding is, if I cannot follow the chapter 12 things, so therefore it's very difficult for me to understand what will please Krishna in a specific circumstance. That is what I was trying to ask.
Oh, okay. Yes, that's true. If you're not connected with Krishna in general, how are you going to know what pleases him specifically? That's very true. In order for my granddaughter to know what pleases me specifically, she has to be attached to me in general. And the only good side is that Krishna wants you to know what will please him both specifically and generally. He wants you, so he'll help you. You just have to ask. It's not really very complicated. You just ask. You can even ask Krishna specifically, and it's not that you have to be fully 100% pure in the general things before you can get specific guidance. That's not true. You can ask. But you got to ask with a willingness to hear the answer and a willingness to hear the answer however it comes. Like, I was reading about this woman who was working for a publishing company and was thinking, should I continue my job at this publishing company, or should I work as a freelance writer? And so she asked. She said, my dear God, you know, what should I do? And the next day she was fired from her job. And she said, oh, that's a pretty clear answer. So we can ask. We can ask. We can say, Krishna, please give me some specific direction. But one's got to be willing to take that direction. A lot of times when we ask, we don't really want to know the answer. This happens in our human relationships all the time. People ask me questions all the time who don't really want to know the answer. Just happened to me recently. Somebody asked me, what should I do in this and this and this circumstance? So I did some research and really looked into it. And then I wrote back to the person and I said, well, you know, here's my suggestions. And then they responded, how dare you make a suggestion? I'm like, oh gosh, will you ask me? So we all have this sort of experience where somebody asks us something, what should I do? And we make a suggestion, and then they get angry. They don't want to hear our suggestions. So we often do that with Krishna. Krishna, please tell me what to do. But we don't really want to know what to do. We only want his answer if he gives us an answer that's, you know, my preconceived idea. How can I, you know, you get the answers, you get questions all the time. How can I change my wife? How can I change my husband? How can I change my mother-in-law? How can I change my boss? And the answer is always, how can you change yourself? That's always the answer. How can you act differently? But people, that's not the answer people want to hear. And so they often get very angry. Oh, you're blaming me for my boss's behavior? How dare you? You know, but you can't change your boss. I mean, you could point a gun to his head and tie him up. You might be able to change your boss's dealings with you by changing your dealings with him. Maybe. It's possible. Might happen. But so this is the way we often deal with Krishna. Krishna, what do you want me to do in this situation? But you can only give me these kind of answers. I won't accept these kinds of answers. Well, then he's not going to say anything because he's smart. You know, I'm stupid. And if somebody asks me how to fix their boss, I may be stupid enough to answer them. You know, I mean, I'd say half the time people ask me for advice, they don't really want my advice. But I'm so stupid, I'll give it anyway. You know, the other day I had a really funny situation where someone asked me some really challenging questions about Shastra, and they were so challenging, and the person had been a devotee for such a long time that I was thinking, the person can't be, maybe this person isn't serious. Maybe they're like playing devil's advocate. So before I answered, I said, are you being sarcastic or are you being serious? And the person was so offended that they just wrote me back a letter. You're just a nonsense and you're not really a devotee and you're just a pretender. And I don't know why I ever asked you anything anyway. And I'll never ask you anything again. And I'm going to tell everybody what nonsense you are. It's like, whoa. So, you know, I'm so stupid that I'll try to answer questions from people who don't really want to know the answer. But Krishna's not so stupid. So if you ask him questions you don't want to know the answer, he'll be silent. He won't say anything. But if you're willing to take whatever answer Krishna gives you, in whatever form he gives you, then everybody has access to infallible and perfect guidance all the time. Everybody. Because everyone's ultimately a devotee, Jivara Swarupaya Krishnara Nityadasha. Even the most fallen reprobate, even the most sinful person, if they pray to God and they sincerely, in that moment, they sincerely want to know, they will get guidance. What to speak of somebody who's in the process? Why will they not get guidance? It's not that first you have to be completely pure. You know, you may not get guidance like a voice from the sky. You may not get guidance like, you know, Krishna walks in your door and looks at you face to face and tells you what to do if you're not fully pure. But he will indicate his desire and what will please him. He will do that. The problem, I'm sorry, is us.
Okay, Dandavat, Ramala Didi.
Dandavat.
There was some comment at the beginning of the class, the devotees were talking and they were saying that the classes are getting better, but I think you're setting the standard and the bar you set is high. So I want to make a comment and then I have a question. The comment is in reference to Mahesh's question. In Atlanta, in 75 or 76, one of the Radha Damodar boys came to the class at the temple, and after the class, he asked Prabhupada with enthusiasm, "What pleases you the most, Srila Prabhupada?" And obviously this devotee was fired up as a traveling book distributor, and he'd heard many classes where this was presented as the most pleasing service to Srila Prabhupada. But Srila Prabhupada didn't answer that question with that you distribute my books. Rather, he paused and said that you learn to love Krishna. So that's what we're all trying to do. So here's the question. And I was talking to Gopa Vrindapal the other day, and he surprised me by saying that Vaishnava Aparad can destroy our stock of Sukriti. And there's a verse, I'll see him today and I'll probably get it. He said it was in Rupa Goswami's Nectar of Devotion. And, you know, previously I thought, okay, if we commit offense to a Vaishnava, it may spoil our attempt in this lifetime and cover, you know, and we'll be covered over again. But then, you know, I had always thought that this eternal bank account couldn't be touched. And Srila Prabhupada, in his books, he says, if you make 1% advancement, that is yours eternally. You know, and one day, you know, that bank account will come to 100% and will go back to Godhead. So I thought nothing could happen to that bank account. But Gopa was saying that you can lose that 1%, 10%, 50%, and that is a scary thought. Therefore, Vaishnava Aparad is to be avoided at all costs. And Srila Prabhupada, I heard him in a talk yesterday when I was driving around, he says, Kali Yuga means fighting. But more intelligent devotees should avoid
this fighting, and especially Aparad, and if someone has taken up devotional service, we should be very careful in our dealings with such persons. Otherwise, what kind of name are we chanting if we are abusing persons who have dedicated their lives to chanting the holy names? And it's we can preach in principle strongly, philosophically, we can preach strongly, but we should be careful about personalizing or demonizing those we don't agree with.
But, did you have a question?
About the bank account. Is that bank account subject to, can that be emptied out by Vaishnava Aparad?
It's not something I can find instantly, but there's a place where Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati is talking about initiation. And he said, once one takes initiation, one is sure to achieve all spiritual success sooner or later. He says, except in very rare instances. So it seems that having that bank account destroyed would be an extremely unusual circumstance. Prabhupada had one disciple, Nittai, who became influenced by the Gaudiya Vaishnavas who criticized Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. There's a group of Gaudiya Vaishnavas who say that Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati did not receive bona fide initiation and that his process is concocted because Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati didn't engage in Siddha Pranali, etc. And so this Nittai became a follower of these groups and very strongly criticized Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati. Srila Prabhupada's response was, it's going to take him 10,000 births to achieve prema. So he didn't say he will not achieve prema. He didn't say everything was finished, but he said the process would be significantly delayed. There's another place where Prabhupada says that if one has association with the pure devotee, that association is sure to bear fruit, but if that association is offensive, one will first have to suffer for those offenses, and then the association will bear fruit. So in most cases, it seems that offenses against devotees simply stop everything. Sometimes it stops partially, and sometimes it stops completely. And you'll see that when people are offensive, they lose the joy. They stop being happy, blissful, and peaceful. They become very disturbed. And they're not really making much progress in bhakti. But in certain instances, yes, it can destroy your bank account. It can certainly destroy your good karma. So I don't know about bhakti, but it can destroy your good karma. And that was the principle with Hiranyakashipu. So Hiranyakashipu had done all this good karma, and he had done the good karma to deserve to run the universe. He had earned it. So what was Lord Vishnu going to do? Because, see, the Lord doesn't like to mess up with the universal laws. If somebody's earned something, he doesn't want to just steal it from them. Then nobody would obey the universal laws anymore. Right? I mean, if you heard that, well, you can work hard and get something, but then Vishnu will just come take it away, then why should anybody work hard and be pious? So therefore, Krishna arranged that a great Vaishnava would become Hiranyakashipu's son. And by offending this Vaishnava, he would be destroying his good karma. And after he committed enough offenses against Prahlad Maharaj, his good karma had run out. And therefore, Nisingadev could kill him without breaking the universal laws. A similar principle is there with Vamandev and Bali Maharaj, that Bali Maharaj had conquered the universe because of his obedience to Sukracharya, a brahmana. And the only way that Vamana was willing to take the universe back was if Bali then offended a brahmana, Sukracharya. So it wasn't until Bali said to Sukracharya, I'm not going to follow your instructions. It was only at that point that Vamandev would take the universe. Because once he disobeyed a brahmana, once he displeased his guru, he lost his pious activities. The result of all those yajnas that he'd done to get the heavenly planets were wiped out. So offenses against devotees can certainly wipe out good karma. Like it said, your duration of life, your riches, your health, your all these things can definitely be wiped out by Vaishnava Aparad. Can bhakti be wiped out by Vaishnava Aparad? I think maybe in very, very, according to Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati's analysis, in extremely unusual cases. But the instances we have in the Shastra is that Vaishnava Aparad significantly delays the fructification of bhakti. So I think we have one more question, and then I have to end. It's getting late.
Thank you, Mataji, for the awesome class and the questions. My question is in reference to Ramananda's question when he was asking about, the fact that we read Bhagavad Gita, we hear Krishna's instructions, and we think that we're following and practicing Krishna consciousness, and yet sometimes we're thinking, we make mistakes, we're not so happy, like you were explaining before. And you answered him so strongly, not just with the words, but with the tone of your voice, about how it's either we're committing offenses or we're not seriously practicing like we think we are. And so my question is that how can we judge ourselves so strongly the way you expressed it in your answer and not discourage ourselves?
Prabhupada said, fan the spark. So find the times when you're experiencing real bhakti. Maybe it was yesterday at 7 a.m. Maybe it was a week ago. Maybe it was a moment ago. Maybe it was a year ago or 5 years ago. Find that moment and focus on that and celebrate that and fan the spark and fan the spark. Never mind what you do wrong. Forget it. It's not important. It's not important. Focus on what you do right and fan the spark. Just like we're supposed to do with the other devotees. With the other devotees, we're supposed to focus on what they do right and fan the spark. Whatever they do wrong, it'll fall by the wayside. Apichetsu characharo. It's not important in the long run. It just isn't. It's important for a moment only. I mean, if the person's our child or our student or our disciple, we have to instruct them and correct them. But fan the spark, fan the spark, fan the spark. Take whatever's there, whatever's sincere. Focus on the sincerity. Focus on the sincerity. When I was recently in Honolulu, one of the devotees there made some cupcakes, and when I ate one, I was like, oh, this is Krishna. This is Krishna. This is not ordinary food. So that experience, the experience when you're in the kirtan, and we all have those experiences. Hopefully we're having them many, many times in a day. But even if it's been a long time, go back to that experience. When was it I ate that gulab jamun and I thought that I was on another planet? Or that I was in the kirtan and time and space went away? Or I was reading Prabhupada's books and I was transported into the lila? Or I had this desire, Krishna, how can I serve you? Or I was chanting japa and I started crying and like, Krishna, I want to serve you. So those are real, and those are indicative that we are making progress. And if we didn't have those experiences, we wouldn't stay. We're not, how long are we going to stay just out of some formality or some ritual? And go for the real. And go for the real. Rather than discouraging us, it shows us that it is in our hand, and I'm not dependent on anybody else. What's discouraging is if I think that no matter what I do, it's still going to be a gradual process, and no matter what I do, it's still going to take forever. It's just the way it is, and I just have to deal with it. That's discouraging. It's discouraging to think that I'm dependent on other people and other circumstances for my advancement. Unless my mother acts like this, or my wife acts like this, or my government acts like this, or my guru acts like this, I can't make advancement. Everybody else has to get it together first. Unless I live in this place, I can't make advancement. Unless I get married, or unless I get unmarried, or unless I, whatever, I can't make advancement. That's discouraging. It's discouraging to think that my ability to connect with Krishna is dependent on things that are completely outside of my control. Or it's just going to, but it isn't. We should feel encouraged that I've done this before. I have experience of connecting with Krishna. I have experience. Maybe it's a shadow experience. Maybe it's a slight experience. Maybe it's a short experience. But I have experience that Krishna is real and Krishna consciousness is real and that I can connect. I have that experience. And therefore, I have some model to work on. And the fact that there's nobody who's responsible but myself isn't a matter of blame and depression. But that means it's in my own hands. It empowers you. It says, it's me. It's only the pride that gets depressed and discouraged thinking I'm being blamed. I'm perfect. How are you saying it's my fault? You're blaming me. You, demon, it's not my fault. I'm the victim. It's everybody else's fault. That's discouraging. God, if I had to wait for everybody else to get it together before I could be Krishna conscious, you know? And I had to wait for my material situation to be perfect. Or I had to take this long, slow road for 10 million births, you know? God, that's awfully discouraging. But if I know it's in my hands, then when I'm messing up, I can say, hey, I'm the one who's messing up. Okay, you know, let me surrender. Let me put myself in a position where I'm going to want to surrender if I see what's the real problem. And then I can work at the real solution. And when I'm working at the real solution, to whatever extent I am, to that extent, I'm going to feel peace and happiness and freedom. Okay, thank you very much. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.